Hello and welcome to episode 7 of All Things Food. I am your host, Nikki Hursthouse. I am a registered dietitian, foodie, and the founder of Nikki Hursthouse Nutrition. This week on the podcast, I've brought back a guest from a really popular episode in season 1. I am joined again by Claudia Babazar from Fertility Nutrition. Claudia was a guest in episode 4 of season 1, talking about all things fertility nutrition. It was a jam-packed episode, which if you haven't tuned into it yet, hop on over and give that a listen. To follow on from that episode, we are continuing along the reproductive journey and diving into a conversation about all things pregnancy nutrition. If you don't know Claudia, she is a member of Australasia's Nutrition Plus, which is a group of experienced and specialized women's health, fertility, and pregnancy dietitians. Claudia has a special interest in unexplained infertility, recurrent miscarriage, and the gut-brain connection within the context of infertility. Welcome back to season 2, Claudia.
Thanks, Nikki. Great to be here.
I'm really excited to chat to you today. So following season 1, where you were a guest and we talked all about fertility nutrition, it was a jam-packed episode and some really interesting insights for everyone who didn't know that much about that topic. And so we're going to continue talking about the reproductive journey today and dive into talking about all things pregnancy nutrition.
Sounds good.
So the concept of eating for two is something we sort of hear a lot about, but is there any semblance of truth in this with regards to the actual nutritional needs of mum and baby during pregnancy?
Yeah, this is a good question, and there are two parts to the answer. So yes, there is a semblance in terms of the nutrient needs. They do increase in pregnancy, absolutely, but the calorie or energy or kilojoule, it's sort of, you know, I guess all means the same thing, those needs certainly don't double. And often we think, oh yep, eating for two, I can eat what I like, but really actually the increase in the amount of calories that we need is only marginal. The first trimester of pregnancy, there isn't really any increase in calorie requirements unless you've got a multiple pregnancy, like even twins or triplets. And then in the second trimester, your requirements increase by maybe one or two additional snacks a day. And then in the third trimester, you know, say up to four additional snacks. So it's certainly not eating for two. And so I liken it to eating smarter as opposed to eating more. So we need a much more nutrient dense diet, and we need to be more sensible about the types of foods that we're eating.
Well, that makes it much more clear. So we're not doubling the volume of food that we're eating.
Yeah.
It's more about the quality over the quantity. And so how does the way that a woman eats during pregnancy affect the baby's physical and mental development?
Yes, so this is an interesting question. And really, it comes down to, I guess, epigenetics. And that is, we're talking here about the first 1,000 days of life. And really, this starts prior to conception up until around the second year of baby's life. And this is what is defined as a golden window of opportunity where certain lifestyle and dietary components can influence the lifelong disease risk of the offspring. So as it's a very sensitive window of development for the baby, but it actually starts sort of around 3 months prior to conception. So it takes 3 months for those, which we probably talked about in the fertility episode, but it takes around 3 months for the little egg follicle of mum and the sperm of dad to mature around the time of ovulation. So in that 3 month window prior to conception and then through pregnancy up until about baby's second year of life is a time where what we eat can basically have the ability to silence the genetic expression for certain conditions and diseases such as obesity and diabetes and heart disease and allergies and autoimmune conditions. So yeah, it's pretty amazing, pretty important time to be focusing on your nutrition and doing what you can to eat well.
So with regards to what a woman can eat during pregnancy, I guess this is sort of one of the first things that maybe women get given a sort of pamphlet on, like foods to eat, foods to avoid. And I guess what are the general recommendations around foods that do need to be avoided during pregnancy, and why are there particular foods that need to be avoided?
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is listeria. And listeria is a type of foodborne illness which is more prevalent and it tends to affect people who are more immunocompromised. And so that can be, you know, young children or elderly and also pregnant women. Because when we're pregnant, our immune system naturally, I guess, subsides a little bit, so we don't reject our own developing fetus. So it's quite clever in that sense, but we are more likely to develop things, to catch the flu or to develop food poisoning. And the reason why listeria is a problem is because it's one of the only bugs that survives in cold temperatures, whereas salmonella and campylobacter and things, they don't grow in the fridge, but listeria can. So theoretically, if you keep it really simple, if you heat a food till it's piping hot, you're going to kill listeria and it will be safe to eat. But in general, we need to avoid things which are considered high-risk foods, such as deli meats, like your ham and any cold meats. They're really high-risk. Foods like rice, which is cold and left over the next day. So you've cooked it and then it's cooled and it's sat in the fridge, so the bugs could grow in the fridge. But if you reheated that rice till it was piping hot, then it would be safe to eat. Other things that we need to avoid are your soft and unpasteurized dairy products, like, soft serve ice creams, unpasteurized milks, cheeses, yogurts, and also things like hummus. So hummus is an interesting one, and actually it's only up until recently that Australia have updated their guidelines around avoiding hummus in pregnancy. But in New Zealand there have been cases where hummus was a source of listeria and there was an outbreak for pregnant women, and that was actually sourced back to the tahini found in the hummus. So if you make your own hummus at home, you can make that without the tahini, keep it in the fridge and use it within 1 or 2 days, and that should be fine. But I do want to point out that, listeria affects only 1% of pregnancies, so we can be, I guess, defined as listeria hysteria, and it's really uncommon. It's unlikely to occur, and the food safety is an important practice that we all should be doing to optimize the outcomes of that pregnancy. And I know that women who are pregnancy want to do all they can to minimize risk of miscarriage, and listeria certainly is an important part of that.
And with regards to food safety across the three trimesters, is there any time or any trimester in particular where sort of the caution around food safety needs to be even higher?
No, I would advise that women follow food safety principles right throughout their pregnancy, regardless of what trimester or stage they're in. Yeah.
Okay. And so aside from food safety, what about other recommendations around foods to, I guess, avoid or that could cause harm during a pregnancy, such as caffeine or alcohol? What are the recommendations for women there?
Good question. And this is a really important question. I'm pleased you've asked it, because there has been some new research published, which is likely to modify future guidelines. So the latest evidence around caffeine, or rather the latest guidelines around caffeine, state that pregnant women should limit their total caffeine consumption to 200 milligrams or below. Now, you can have quite variable amounts of caffeine in a coffee depending on the barista, the type of bean, the grind of the coffee. So it's quite hard to get a consistent level of caffeine in each coffee, even if you're going to the same coffee shop. So a double shot flat white could give you 200 milligrams of caffeine. So I do try and encourage women to, if they are having coffee, to at least keep it to a single shot. However, you know, last year some new research came out. It wasn't new data. It was looking at the existing data, but it was a review of the data to date. And that outlined that there may not be a safe level of caffeine in pregnancy. So my advice to women is, if you can go without coffee, that's great. If you really need that morning cup of coffee, then try and keep it to a single shot maximum. And bearing in mind that you also get caffeine from other food sources, such as green tea or your English breakfast, Earl Grey, dark chocolate. So, you know, you may want to substitute that morning cup of coffee and allow yourself to have a little bit of dark chocolate throughout your pregnancy. So I guess it's going to be individual there, individual preferences. And if you are unsure about your caffeine intake, then I'd recommend chatting with your doctor or your midwife or your dietitian, so you can get some really tailored advice around that and feel confident that you're not exceeding the recommended amount in pregnancy. And in terms of alcohol, historically it has been thought that you could have, you know, one or two drinks safely in pregnancy, but new research showed that there's actually no safe level of alcohol in pregnancy regardless of trimester. It showed that alcohol intake was associated with lower birth weights and cognitive deficits in offspring. So absolutely avoid alcohol in pregnancy no matter what trimester.
And say someone is in a very early stage of pregnancy and maybe they don't know that they're pregnant yet. This is jumping back to so that fertility nutrition aspect as well as the early stages of pregnancy. But what's the recommendation there? Is it to avoid alcohol once you start trying to conceive so you don't risk having any intake in that early few weeks of pregnancy?
I mean, ideally, yes, but, you know, approximately half of New Zealand pregnancies are unplanned, so you're not always going to be in that position. And look, if you do have alcohol, it's not to say that you're not going to have a healthy baby. It's just if you are in a position where you have that prior knowledge, then obviously avoiding it is going to be a really sensible thing to do. And from a fertility perspective, we do know that alcohol reduces your fertility. It causes oxidative damage. And is detrimental. So, you know, if you are actively planning to have a baby and trying to conceive or going through fertility treatment or struggling with infertility, then avoiding alcohol is going to be sensible and advised. But on the other flip of the coin, if you are someone who has been going through infertility for a really long time, you know, the odd glass of red wine with dinner whilst you're not pregnant is something that might really help you relax and is more sustainable rather than total abstinence. So again, I think that is slightly individualized.
Valid points. And also everyone's situation is really different. So like you said, it's just making sure that you're getting personalized advice as well. If you feel like your situation, it doesn't sort of fall into the generalized guidelines.
Yeah, absolutely.
So with regards to the types of food that mum's eating during pregnancy, I mean, obviously there can be times where morning sickness or reflux or any other symptoms can affect what mum eats. But how does the food eaten during pregnancy help to evolve the flavour palate in baby?
Yeah, good question. So there was some research done which showed that, you know, taste buds at around that 4 months gestation are being developed. So what a mother is eating at that time may influence food preferences in the offspring. So that, I guess, comes back to having a really balanced diet and having food from all the different food groups and having as much variety as possible.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And it'll be great to see, you know, more research looking into how future kids' taste preferences and sort of acceptance of food can be influenced during pregnancy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's probably only one piece of the puzzle. You know, there's going to be a whole lot of other factors once baby's born, which have an impact too. I don't think that's the sole source of baby's palate, but I think it certainly plays a role, and it just adds more weight to mums and mums to be to having more of a focus around their nutrition at preconception and
pregnancy. And I guess there's a lot of talk around around food during pregnancy, but what about what we're drinking and actual fluid intake and hydration? So how important is it to focus on what you're drinking and how much you're drinking during pregnancy?
Good question. So hydration is really, really important, and I completely agree with you on the importance of hydration. You know, you want to be having at least 2 litres a day of fluid, and, you know, the major proportion of the body is water. So it's involved in every major cell function and bodily function. So it's really important to have sufficient fluid status. It can also help with pregnancy complications such as constipation. So it is an important thing to do. And often, you know, if you are having nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, then you've got higher outputs. So you need to be mindful of fluid status and hydration. And it can be difficult. A lot of women struggle with fluid in pregnancy. So having, you know, regular little and often sips of fluid and trying to flavour the water with lemon juice or mint or ginger, utilising sparkling water as ways to try and keep the fluid intake up is really important,
And is there a significant increase in the amount of fluid that women do need during pregnancy?
Yes, there is. So, you know, we want to be having at least 2 litres of water a day, but that would depend on the individual, because we all have different levels of what we call insensible water losses. So if you're someone who exercises regularly and sweats a lot, then you're going to have higher fluid requirements compared to someone who doesn't sweat much. But as a basis, as a baseline rule, you know, try and get at least 2 litres a day, 2 to 3 litres, and there will be slight variations. You want to aim for just a pale straw-coloured urine. If it's darker than that, you need to increase your fluid intake. And, you know, obviously we don't want to be having 5 litres a day and drowning ourselves in water, because there is such a thing as too much.
Too much of a good thing.
Totally.
Yeah. So morning sickness could be in the morning or it could be all day, but also other sort of symptoms in pregnancy like constipation or reflux can all influence how much or what a woman really can eat during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. What are your sort of key tips to help with these symptoms in pregnancy?
Yeah, it's a hard one, isn't it? Look, pregnancy nausea is just the pits. And often, as you said, it's all day, every day. And it can last beyond the first trimester. It usually will peak for most women at around the 14 weeks. And generally, from 90% of women should subside by, you know, 16 weeks gestation. So, the main tips I have for women are to eat little and often. If we have an empty stomach, we're more likely to be nauseated, and it can also help to get nutrients in. My second tip is to make yourself a cold platter, so veggie sticks, chopped up fruit, some nuts, some whole grain crackers, maybe some cheese, just to help you get a variety of foods across the different food groups. And often cold foods are better tolerated when you have nausea compared to cooked foods. So that I find works quite well for people. I've talked about flavouring water, and you know that's important again with the little and often to help constipation, to prevent constipation and dehydration. But I do want to point out that sometimes first trimester particularly is about survival, and it can be so hard. I remember when I was pregnant with my daughter, and gosh, I felt so sick for 18 weeks and it was just awful. And I'm a dietitian and I struggled to eat anything but a beige carbohydrate. And I had all these visions of going into my pregnancy of having a beautiful Mediterranean diet with all the fruits and vegetables, and I just couldn't eat it. And I was quite horrified with myself. So I empathize for women who are in this situation, because it can actually be quite distressing when you know that you're meant to be nourishing your little baby being with all the goodness, but you physically can't do it. So sometimes it's about survival, and that's okay. If you are in that situation, reaching out to a dietitian or your lead maternity carer is a really good idea to get some support. And it highlights for me the significance and importance of preconception nutrition, particularly those 3 months going prior to pregnancy, so that we can, if you're eating really well during that time and really building up your nutrient stores, that's going to set you up well going into that first trimester if you really can't eat that well. You know, at least you're coming off a high base. So, yeah, they're my take-homes.
And it's a really valid point, isn't it? I guess if it's a planned pregnancy, then you may have that 3 months to sort of focus on your nutrition, and that's what we really talked about in that fertility nutrition episode. Mm-hmm. And we sort of briefly touched on folate and supplements in the fertility nutrition episode, but when it comes to pregnancy, what's the sort of go-to when it comes to folate? Is taking a mixed pregnancy multivitamin going to do the job?
Good question. Supplements are a bit of a minefield. So I guess I want to try and keep my advice on this podcast really simple so that we don't add to the confusion. In New Zealand, the recommendation is to have at least 400 micrograms of folate a day in pregnancy, so taking at least a 400 microgram supplement a day, as well as 150 micrograms of iodine. So you don't have to have a pregnancy multi. You can take the folic acid and the iodine, which is available from your GP. That is the recommendation to do that. Taking the folic acid prior to pregnancy is a really good idea. Pharmac, there is a bit of confusion, because Pharmac only fund an 800 microgram tablet and a 5 milligram tablet. So often the advice coming from health professionals is you must take an 800 microgram supplement of folic acid, and then you're buying a New Zealand over-the-counter pregnancy multi, and it may only have 400 or 500 micrograms of folate in it, and there is concern that you're not getting enough. But for the majority of people who don't have an increased requirement for higher folate, the 400 micrograms is sufficient on top of a healthy, balanced diet where we also get folate. And that should be sufficient for you to meet your needs in the first trimester and throughout your entire pregnancy.
Yeah. And there is some conflicting information out in the world of the internet around folate, and there have been some people putting out information saying that you don't necessarily need to take folate supplements if you eat lots of green leafy veggies. Can women really get that 400 micrograms from their diet?
Yeah, so to be clear, it's recommended that we take at least a 400 microgram supplement on top of our dietary intake. And, you know, I've seen hundreds of women and I look at their dietary intake and I do dietary analyses through software where I can actually see quantitatively their nutrient intake. And 90% of the time, women are not meeting their recommended daily intake of folate for non-pregnancy. So the non-pregnancy recommended daily intake is 400 micrograms and that increases to 600 micrograms in pregnancy. So there's a real deficit there, which highlights the real importance of having a folate supplement. So I don't agree with advice to say that you don't need to take a folate supplement. That is not based on good evidence, and I certainly don't agree with that.
And that's really good to clarify, because it's just increasing that sort of awareness that it's in addition to what you are already eating.
Correct.
And it's really interesting to know that, you know, a lot of people are not meeting that, you know, base dietary intake of folate in itself.
That's right. Yeah.
And I guess just in the final sort of question around folate is that there are a few different types of folic acid that you can supplement with, and there's a little bit of information out there and it can get a little bit confusing with the different names. But is that something that the majority of women need to worry about, or like what you said before, the prescription folic acid that you can get from your GP is sufficient and a sufficient form of folate?
Yeah, good question. And yes, it is getting really confusing. There are different types of folate. You have folic acid, folinic acid, 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, levomethylfolate. It's a minefield, and it's something that you really need to get specialised advice around, and a specialised fertility dietitian is the best person to give you that advice. For the vast majority of the population, folic acid is absolutely safe and appropriate, and all the evidence around prevention of neural tube defects shows that folic acid prevents neural tube defects. So there's actually no good, strong, robust literature out there telling us that methylated folate prevents neural tube defects. Bearing in mind, it's a very difficult area to study in a randomized controlled trial, because ethically, how do we put people in a group of folic acid and then methylated folate when we know that folic acid prevents neural tube defects? So admittedly, it's very hard to study for a gold standard randomized controlled trial. But there are some people who have a very small percentage of the population who do have a gene polymorphism or a gene defect where they don't produce the enzyme that converts folic acid into the methylated folate. Therefore, in those people, a methylated folate may be a better option. However, I want to point out that even in that small group of people, they are still able to convert a very small amount of folic acid into methylated folate. So, you know, folic acid is certainly safe and appropriate for the majority of women trying to conceive, and I recommend that they take a folate supplement of some sort. Whether or not you want folic acid or methylated folate, you know, I really think that you should get individualized advice around that, but for the majority of people, folic acid is the way to go, and no need for anything else. There are people who have higher needs for folate, such as those with a malabsorption condition such as Crohn's disease, or who have had gastric surgery, those with a high BMI, those taking anticonvulsant medications. There are a few examples. Those group of people do need a higher dose of folate. And again, that should be discussed with your health professional to make sure that you're getting the right dose, and B, you know, making sure that there's no indication that you have a gene polymorphism. It's not something that's routinely tested in New Zealand. It can be tested more frequently in other countries, so it makes it a little bit tricky.
Mm.
But usually, you know, there would be other things indicating that there might be a problem, such as, you know, recurrent miscarriage. That would be a bit of a red flag. But I think in those situations, that's where you're really going to be getting additional support and hopefully individualized nutrition advice to help give you a really clear plan around what supplements to take for your needs.
Yeah, yeah. And you touched on those sort of reasons of why a woman might need higher doses of folate, which is great. And I guess one other sort of area that the really sensitive area is around falling pregnant again after a miscarriage or multiple miscarriages. And is there anything that needs to be considered when it comes to nutrition if you fall pregnant again after a miscarriage?
Yeah, look, I mean, recurrent pregnancy loss is a special interest of mine. So I want to highlight that the majority of women who do have a miscarriage will go on to have a live birth. So that's the first point. The other point I want to make is that you can only control what you can control. So when it comes with regards to nutrition, that's where we're focusing on, you know, making sure we're not having any alcohol, really looking at our caffeine, total caffeine intake, taking correct supplementation. And there was an Italian study actually which showed that eating two pieces of fruit a day was associated with a 50% reduction in miscarriage. So these are all strategies and things that I look at for individuals, making sure that we're really optimizing their nutrition to mitigate their risk for miscarriage. Again, it goes back to that, I guess, egg quality, sperm quality 3 months prior to conception to make a healthy embryo. We know that the majority of miscarriages occur because of chromosomal abnormalities, and chromosomal abnormalities are caused by oxidative damage. The main contributor to that, of course, is age. We can't do anything about that, unfortunately. So the other factors which contribute to oxidative damage, such as, you know, smoking, alcohol, exercise, stress, nutrition, they become really important because they're factors that we can control. So I guess nutrition is a modifiable factor, and that's where a fertility or prenatal dietitian comes in to really try and ensure that you're having a nutritionally complete and optimal diet going into a pregnancy to optimize the chance of having a live birth.
It's really interesting. And I think it's really, really nice fact that you shared around women who've had a miscarriage going on to have a live birth, which is a nice sort of positive message to hold on to for some who've had recurrent pregnancy loss.
Yeah, that's right. Majority, absolutely. Even if you've had three or more, the majority will still go on to have a live birth. So, yeah. There's hope.
Yeah. Yeah. And another area around food and pregnancy that sort of crops up from time to time is around allergies, or sort of preventing allergies, or trying to sort of manipulate the outcome of whether the baby will have allergies. So what is the evidence around including or excluding particular foods at any point in time during pregnancy in an attempt to reduce the risk of a baby developing particular allergies?
Yeah, so allergies is an interesting one. We know that, you know, if either the mother or the father has a food allergy, the baby has about a 30% increased risk for having a food allergy. And if both parents have a food allergy, the risk increases to about 60%. And that's because there's a genetic component there. You know, the risk of food allergies is genetic. And genetic programming also has a role in allergy risk. So that comes, loops back round to the nutrition in the first 1,000 days and how it can have an impact on genetic programming. And it can influence whether or not that baby will have a food allergy. So historically, the advice, you know, around peanuts was to avoid peanuts in pregnancy so your baby doesn't develop a peanut allergy. And more recent data has shown that actually that increases the risk for baby having anaphylaxis to peanuts at 1 year of age. So the advice has flipped on its head in recent years to actually make sure that in pregnancy you are trying to expose baby to all the common allergens, you know, in whilst in the womb, and also making sure that there is exposure when introducing solids and before the first year of life. So, yeah, interesting.
Mm. It is really interesting, isn't it? I do recall hearing of women who in their last half a trimester sort of started to exclude eggs and dairy and soy and peanuts to reduce the risk, or attempt to reduce the risk of not just allergies, but sort of, I guess, even skin issues or anything like that. Mm. But it doesn't seem from what you've said that there is much basis to that.
No. And in fact, what you're doing when you're cutting out foods is that you're cutting out nutrients. And for instance, eggs are such an important source of choline. And choline is associated with cognitive development of your infant. So, you know, you need to be really careful if you're cutting and excluding foods from your diet. You really should do that in consultation with a dietitian to make sure that it's safe, and that if you are cutting a food out, that it's being replaced with another food that's giving you that nutrient or group of nutrients, or you're getting correct supplementation to fill that void.
Yeah. And I mean, when it comes to making sure you're getting enough nutrients, what are the main considerations for multiple pregnancies, say for twins or triplets?
Mm. My take home here is that anyone who's having a twin or multiple pregnancy should be working with a fertility or prenatal dietitian, because the needs are so much greater. So, for example, you know, calcium needs are 50% greater in a twin pregnancy compared to a singleton. You're 8 times more likely to have a folate deficiency in a twin pregnancy compared to a singleton. There are higher rates of preeclampsia, gestational diabetes in a twin pregnancy, which can be influenced by nutrition. You know, it was quite interesting, the growing up in New Zealand study, the data has come out quite recently, and that showed that only 3% of pregnant women, and this is a singleton pregnancy, only 3% of pregnant women actually eat the recommended number of serves from the different food groups. So there's quite significant gaps in the nutrient intake in pregnant diets. And so if you extrapolate that out into a twin pregnancy or a multiple pregnancy, the deficit is likely to be even greater. And, you know, protein in terms of a macronutrient, that is often something that I see is really lacking in twin pregnancies. And it's quite hard, actually, to meet your protein needs in a multiple pregnancy. It's quite a substantial increase. And we don't want people to be reaching for protein powders over the counter, because we don't actually know what's in them. It's an unregulated market. They can often have caffeine in them and ingredients in them which are not stated on the label. So, you know, it's just a really important time to be working with a dietitian, really.
Yeah, some really interesting considerations there. And I mean, yeah, just trying to sort of think how, I mean, we talked about quality over quantity and the amount of food, but to be able to get the amount of quality you need for like a twin or multiple pregnancy whilst managing other complications or side effects that you might have, it's that's a minefield to sort of keep on top of on your own.
Totally. It's really hard to navigate that on your own. And then you also have, you know, I guess in this age where we have social media, there's all this sort of conflicting information and it's confusing. And, you know, you have the seed of doubt and then there's the anxiety and the worry. So, you know, if you are able to cut through that noise and get personalized advice, it does really give you a very clear plan, which is evidence-based. Mm. It gives you that confidence to know that you're doing the right thing for your needs and you don't have to worry. So it's, it's a great thing to be able to do if you can.
And is there any other area of pregnancy nutrition that we haven't covered that you want to talk about?
Well, look, it's such a broad topic. My biggest emphasis for women is to try and eat foods from all of the different food groups. You know, it's really tempting to be gluten-free and dairy-free and cutting out food groups and, you know, it's important that you do try and eat foods from all the different food groups because that's your best way of meeting your nutrient requirements. One thing we haven't talked about is vegetarian and vegan diets in pregnancy. Now, these are two areas where I highly recommend that you work with a dietitian because the nutrients that you're more likely to be deficient in with a vegetarian and vegan diet are very critical for a healthy pregnancy, such as iron and B12 and choline and omega-3s. So that's a very important area in consideration. So if you are vegetarian, make sure you try and reach out to the dietitian or your GP at the very least, or look on the Ministry of Health website for some guidance on having a safe vegetarian diet in pregnancy so that you can do that safely.
Yeah, really good point there. And so what would your three take-home messages be for pregnant women about looking after their bodies and their baby during pregnancy?
Yeah, so it's an important time not only because you're creating a life and you're growing a baby, but also because often the transition into motherhood can be a challenging one mentally. And, you know, with these higher rates of postnatal depression compared to the general public. So nutrition is a modifiable risk factor for depression as well. So my take homes are obviously the first one is eat a variety of foods from all the different food groups. Number two is to aim for 2 serves of fruit a day and 5 serves of vegetables with a rainbow of colours. And the third one is, you know, realising that what a woman eats in pregnancy influences the lifelong disease risk of her offspring. So if ever there's a time in your life where you're going to see a dietitian and prioritize your nutrition and do that for yourself, that is the time to do it because it has such a big impact on future generations. So, you know, maybe that's something that can be part of, you know, a baby shower. You know, it's a nice, even a gift that you can give a friend who's pregnant or, you know, family might want to gift it as a Christmas present. It's just a consultation with a dietitian to have a nutrition assessment so you can have that good, clear, personalised information. It's worth its weight in gold.
Really good. And, I mean, obviously, if any pregnant ladies are listening, where can they find you?
So they can find us at Fertility Nutrition. That's www.fertilitynutrition.co.nz and also on Instagram. We are Fertility Nutrition Dietitians and we share lots of generalized nutrition information for the general public on fertility and pregnancy nutrition on Instagram. So you can certainly find some info there.
That's great. And thank you so much for joining to sort of continue the discussions along the reproductive journey today. We sort of made our way halfway through that first 1,000 days, I guess, haven't we?
Yeah,
from fertility, nutrition to then pregnancy. And then maybe you'll be back in season three to finish off that first 1,000 days.
Yeah. Pleasure, Nikki. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Don't forget to subscribe so you can find out when new episodes are released. And if you love the podcast, please consider leaving a review so more people can discover it. In the meantime, you can follow the podcast and my work over on Instagram and Facebook at Nourish with Nikki. And to find out more about working with me one-to-one to improve your gut health, energy, and mood, then visit nikkihursthouse.com to book your free discovery call today.